Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, September 13th, 2024. We begin with page one, where there's a beautiful collage of photos titled The Wonder of Nature, and the caption reads, Volunteer J.C. Dixon weeds and gets roses ready on Thursday for the 19th annual Autumnal Festival planned this weekend at the Illinois State University Horticulture Center. This year's theme is Awestruck 2024, The Wonder of Nature, and activities are planned from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday and 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday. Admission is $10 for ages 13 and up, $5 for ages 3 to 12, and free for ages 2 and younger. The Horticulture Center is on Rab Road in Normal, across the street from the Corn Crib. For more information, go to horticulturecenter.illinoisstate.edu. And the photographs are of Ms. Dixon working in the garden, of some beautiful sunflowers, and volunteers setting up a tent on Thursday for the upcoming event. And our first story on page one is about politics, headlined, Ohio City Lands in Immigration Spotlight. Trump amplifies lies about Haitians. This is an Associated Press story, datelined Springfield, Ohio. Many cities have been reshaped by immigrants in the last few years without attracting much notice, not Springfield, Ohio. Its story of economic renewal and related growing pains has been thrust into the national conversation in a presidential election year and distorted by false rumors that Haitian immigrants are eating their neighbors' pets. Donald Trump amplified those lies during Tuesday's nationally televised debate, exacerbating some residents' fears about growing divisiveness in the predominantly white blue-collar city of about 60,000. Officials in Springfield have tried to tamp down the misinformation by saying there have been no credible or detailed reports of any pets being abducted or eaten. At the city's Haitian Community Help and Support Center on Wednesday, Rose Tamar Joseph said many of the roughly 15,000 immigrants who arrived in the past few years were drawn by good jobs and the city's relative affordability. But a rising sense of unease has crept in as longtime residents increasingly bristle at newcomers taking jobs at factories, driving up housing costs, worsening traffic, and straining city services. Some of them are talking about living in fear. Some of them are scared for their life, Joseph said. A welcome to our city sign hangs from a parking garage downtown, where a coffee shop, bakery, and boutique line Springfield's main drag, North Fountain Street. A flag advertising Culture Fest, the city's annual celebration of unity through diversity, waves from a pole nearby. Melanie Flax Wilt, a Republican commissioner in the county where Springfield is located, said she has been pushing for community and political leaders to stop feeding the fear. After the election and everybody's done using Springfield, Ohio as a talking point for immigration reform, we are going to be the ones here still living through the challenges and coming up with the solutions, she said. Ariel Dominique, executive director of the Haitian American Foundation for Democracy, said she laughed at first at the absurdity of the false claims, but seeing the comments repeated on national television by the former president was painful. It is so unfair and unjust and completely contrary to what we have contributed to the world, what we have contributed to this nation for so long, Dominique said. With its rising population of immigrants, Springfield is hardly an outlier. So far this decade, immigration has accounted for almost three-quarters of U.S. population growth, with 2.5 million immigrants arriving in the United States between 2020 and 2023, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. The falsehoods about Springfield's Haitian immigrants were spread online by Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, on the eve of Tuesday's debate between Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris. "This is what's happening in our country, and it is a shame," Trump said at the debate after repeating the falsehoods. When challenged by ABC News moderator David Muir over the false claims, Trump held firm, saying people on television said their dogs were eaten, but he offered no evidence. State leaders, meanwhile, are trying to help address some of the real challenges facing the city. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, a Republican, said Tuesday he would add more law enforcement and health care resources to an aid package the state has already provided to Springfield. Many Haitians have come to the U.S. to flee poverty and violence. They have embraced President Joe Biden's new and expanded legal pathways to enter and have shunned illegal crossings, accounting for only 92 border arrests out of more than 56,000 in July, the latest data available. The Biden administration recently announced an estimated 300,000 Haitians in the U.S. could remain in the country at least through February 2026, with eligibility for work authorization under a law called Temporary Protected Status. The goal is to spare people from being deported to countries in turmoil. Springfield, about 45 miles from the state capital of Columbus, suffered a steep decline in its manufacturing sector toward the end of the last century, and its population shrank as a result. But its downtown has been revitalized in recent years as more Haitians arrived and helped meet the rising demand for labor as the economy emerged from the pandemic. Officials say Haitians now account for about 15% of the population. The city was shaken last year when a minivan slammed into a school bus, killing an 11-year-old boy. The driver was a Haitian man who recently settled in the area and was driving without a valid license. During a city commission meeting on Tuesday, the boy's parents condemned politicians' use of their son's death to stoke hatred. Last week, a post on the social media platform X shared what looked like a screen grab of a social media post apparently out of Springfield. The post claimed, without evidence, that the person's neighbor's daughter's friend saw a cat hanging from a tree to be butchered and eaten outside a house where it claimed Haitians lived. It was accompanied by a photo of a black man carrying what appeared to be a goose by its feet. On Monday, Vance posted on X, "Reports now show that people have had their pets abducted and eaten by people who shouldn't be in this country." The next day, he posted again, saying his office had received inquiries from Springfield residents who said their neighbors' pets or local wildlife were abducted by Haitian migrants. Longtime Springfield resident Chris Hazel, who knows the park and neighborhood where the pet and goose abductions were purported to have happened, called the claims preposterous. "It reminds me of when people used to accuse others and outsiders as cannibals. It's dehumanizing a community," he said, of the accusations against the city's Haitian residents. Sophia Pierellis, the daughter of a former Haitian diplomat who moved to the Ohio capital of Columbus 15 years ago and is now an immigrant advocate, agreed, calling it all political. "My view is that's their way to use Haitians as a scapegoat to bring some kind of chaos in America," she said. And our next front page story is about Bloomington, titled "Death Cafe Event Lets People Have Tough Talks." This story is Dateline Bloomington. An event this Sunday afternoon will encourage conversation about something no one ever seems to want to talk about: death and dying. Carly Kottner of Normal, an end-of-life doula and founder of Reverent Partings, plans to host a Death Cafe event from 2 to 3:30 p.m. Sunday, September 15th at the Blooming Life Studio and Spa at 2412 East Washington Street in Bloomington. An end-of-life doula is someone who helps guide a person who is dying while also helping their loved ones through the process. This may include legacy projects to remember the one who is dying, meditation, dementia care, and more. Death is uncomfortable. People don't like to talk about it, Kottner said. There are natural processes that occur when someone is actively dying every day. It's scary. Kottner, who has a background in healthcare and currently works at Associates in Dermatology in Bloomington, trained with the International End-of-Life Doula Association over the summer and is now working to obtain her certification. She said she introduces herself as an end-of-life doula as opposed to a death doula because it sounds less harsh, though the terms can be used interchangeably. I had begun classes to become a birth doula, and it's wonderful and beautiful, but it was just not for me, she said. I Googled death doula one night, and so many things came up. Kottner said this was how she first discovered the Doula Association, where she ended up applying for a scholarship and taking classes. End-of-life care was also something she encountered in her previous role as an activity director for the Loft Rehabilitation and Nursing in Normal. Kottner said her job there was to keep the residents upbeat, happy, and active, and she noticed that their families struggled when it was time for staffers to leave at the end of their shifts. She added the loft had and still has a hospice cart containing comfort items for families putting their energy into caring for their loved ones. The carts included things like protein bars, tissues, breath mints, bottled water, sodas, ice buckets, and coloring books and crayons for kids. Around this time, Kottner said she was also remembering being in the hospital with her grandfather at the end of his life. It killed me emotionally and physically. It was so hard, she said. Hospice is great, but I didn't know that it wasn't round-the-clock care, she said, of what made her realize there was a need for this kind of role. Sunday will mark the second Death Cafe event that Kottner has hosted. The first was in July, also at Blooming Life Studio. Blooming Life owner Kim Hayes said she had found a Facebook post from Kottner looking for a place to host her death cafes, and she reached out to suggest her business, as she describes it, as a place for healing and wellness. Once I met with Carly and learned her story and what the death cafe represents, I was super excited to be able to offer the space, Hayes said. It's such an important topic, and we both would like to offer a space where some of the taboo nature can be stripped away, and we can all just be real and honest about our feelings around death and the process. Kottner described the Death Cafe as a group discussion on death, dying, and everything in between. During the July event, we did have some people touch on how do we discuss death with our parents because they are aging. People want to respect their parents' wishes, but they don't know what they are, Kottner said. I hope they left with the courage to continue pestering their parents in a gentle, loving way so they can have this conversation. While the discussions are heavy, Kottner said, there also are lighthearted and humorous moments and that it's important to find the joy when talking about difficult topics. We had a really lovely turnout the first time, and everyone ended up feeling comfortable enough to share something, so it was really amazing, Hayes said. Blooming Life is always a judgment-free zone, so anyone can feel safe coming into the space, whether they like to share or just be there to listen. Hayes said she would definitely like to host death cafes on a regular basis. Sunday's event is free, and registration is optional via Facebook. Coffee, tea, and snacks will be available during the event. And those who are interested in Kottner's end-of-life doula services can visit her Reverent Partings website. And our last front page story is the Cutting Board column, this one titled Collard Greens and the Necessity of Innovation. Here on the Cutting Board, we talk about all kinds of foods and try to keep things as simple as possible. But throughout history, people have had to get crafty with the ingredients they had available to them. we can explore what folks ate during the Great Depression to see just how creative they got. Look up the mock apple pie made with Ritz crackers. This human ingenuity is about one thing, feeding each other. For centuries in the American South, enslaved black people had to make do with what they could forage. In his 1853 autobiography, 12 Years a Slave, Solomon Northrop wrote about the scraps that enslaved people were given for meager meals. One of the only times they got to feast was around the holidays, and the dishes served at this time, like Hoppin' John, a dish of peas and rice, are still very important to African American and black culture. So today, let's take a look at one of the greatest innovations in modern history, collard greens. Now, I didn't grow up eating a lot of tougher greens. The heartiest green I ate was spinach that came out of a can or from a brick in the freezer. Collard greens take a lot more time and technique to prepare because they are very fibrous and quite bitter. I actually did not eat collard greens until I lived in Chicago and really started to dive into different food cultures. And I have to be honest, it took me several tries before I felt like I was doing this dish and its cultural significance justice. Some of the authors and cooks I began to research, like Michael W. Twitty and Jessica B. Harris, have inspired my dish in today's column. But the dish is also directly influenced by Adrienne Lipscomb's recipe published in Black Food and edited by Bryant Terry. Cayenne Glen grows collards, along with other greens, at the table in Bentown, east of Bloomington. Collards are members of the brassica family, which also includes broccoli and Brussels sprouts, he said. They prefer cooler weather, Glen said, but what I like about them, I've been able to successfully grow them all season long, similar to how I grow kale or chard. The plant has a main stalk that continues to grow, and Glenn picks the young leaves that spring up as the plant grows. He sells the greens at his farm and at the downtown Bloomington Farmers Market. Today's recipe calls for about 2 pounds of collard greens, which means 4 bunches from Glenn. I'll also be using pot liquor, which is what the liquid portion of this dish is called. Yes, that's the way it's spelled, L-I-K-K-E-R, and it also happens to be super flavorful and nourishing. Greens as a dish can be made with a variety of hearty, leafy greens like turnip and mustard greens. Oftentimes, a dish of greens will have several types in it. Most traditional greens recipes also call for a piece of smoked meat, either ham or turkey. You can find smoked ham hocks or turkey pieces in most supermarkets around Bloomington Normal, and I picked up a 2-pack of Frick's smoked turkey drumsticks at Kroger for about $10. If you are using a piece of cured meat that has been salt cured, you'll want to soak and rinse it at least twice to get the extra salt out of it. If you skip this step, the pot liquor will be way too salty. You can omit the meat to make this a vegetarian dish, and Harris does have such a version in her book, High on the Hog, but today we're sticking with the meat. Making greens takes time and a good workspace, but doesn't require a lot of tools outside a heavy bottom pot and a good wash basin because the greens need to be washed. You could use your sink, but I have a large bowl that I like to use. While I was washing the greens, I had filled a large pot with enough water, about 10 cups, to just cover one turkey drum, and set it to simmer over medium-low heat with the lid fully on. Now, remove the woody stem from the leaves by holding the stem in one hand, grasping the leaves loosely in the other, and pulling your hands apart. Roll up the leaves and cut them into thick ribbons about 1.5 inch wide. Wash these in cold water, draining and refilling the water at least 3 times. This softens the greens' texture. I've seen people rinse and repeat up to 6 times even for velvety greens. Dice a large onion and finely mince 4 cloves of garlic, along with any other aromatic vegetables you want to add, like hot or sweet peppers. After about an hour of simmering, the meat should be starting to pull apart from the bone. Add all the collard greens and aromatic vegetables, along with a good pinch of salt and 2 teaspoons of oregano. Because the turkey is so lean, I added about 1/3 of a stick of butter, a little more than 3 tablespoons. Cover the pot, mostly with the lid, and let simmer at least another 45 minutes to an hour until the meat starts to easily fall off the bone. Remove the turkey drum and set it to the side to cool. Turn the heat to low and keep the greens simmering to reduce the pot liquor a bit. Once the drumstick is cool enough to handle, remove the skin and meat, returning the meat to the pot, and stir to combine and taste for salt. Serve with fresh cornbread to soak up the stew and top with hot peppers, hot sauce, diced onions, or whatever else is your fancy. This dish will take 2.5 to 3 hours to make, but it is so worth it. The greens will have a meaty bite, but velvet texture, and the hearty stew fills not only the belly, but the soul as well. If you are a farmer or a producer and would like to talk with me for this column, call me at 309-820-3275 or email daniel.alkire@lee.net. And be sure to check back next time to find out what we're chopping up on the cutting board. And we turn now to some local and state news. This story is from Decatur, headlined, "Police Arrest Youth Suspects After School Threats." Police say an investigation into threats of violence at Decatur area schools led to the arrest of 2 youths aged 11 and 13 and the seizure of multiple firearms at the older child's home. Authorities with multiple law enforcement agencies and school districts across Macon County confirmed on Wednesday night that they were investigating threats directed at multiple local schools that circulated on social media. Officers stationed near campuses on Thursday sought to provide additional police presence and security. The Decatur Police Department arrested the youths after investigating 2 separate threats received Wednesday, one directed at Stephen Decatur Middle School and one that did not identify a specific school target, according to Lieutenant Scott Rosenberry. The 13-year-old was arrested in connection with the threats toward the middle school and was detained at the Peoria County Juvenile Detention Center on a disorderly conduct charge tied to making a school threat. The 11-year-old suspect was arrested in connection with the second threat, Rosenberry said, but could not be detained because of age-related restrictions outlined in state law. The child was involuntarily admitted to a local hospital, he said, and would also face a disorderly conduct charge in juvenile court. Further identifying details were not released because those charged are younger than 18. Police executed search warrants at the homes of both youths, Rosenberry said. They did not find any guns at the 11-year-old's residence. At the 13-year-old's residence, police seized multiple firearms that were owned by one of the suspect's family members who has a valid firearm owner's identification card, Rosenberry said. He added that the same 13-year-old was involved just last month in a separate incident involving a similar threat. The youths are not believed to have collaborated, according to Rosenberry. The second threat is believed to be a potential copycat incident. The local agencies were not alone. Law enforcement leaders in communities across the country reported similar threats of violence on Wednesday, a date synonymous with tragedy for Americans, recognizing the anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. Wednesday's threats came 1 week after 2 students and 2 teachers were killed and 9 other people injured in a shooting at Appalachie High School in Barrow County, Georgia. A 14-year-old Colt Gray is charged with murder in the case, and Father Colin Gray is accused of second-degree murder for providing his son with a semi-automatic AR-15-style rifle. Local law enforcement interviewed them both last year while investigating whether the younger Gray had posted an online threat, a tip they were ultimately unable to substantiate. Among the school threats reported in local media outlets across the country on Wednesday, threats against multiple school districts in North Texas led to increased police patrols near campuses and rescheduling of several football games. Authorities in San Diego said they were working with other agencies to investigate threats made this week against multiple elementary, middle, and high schools across the city of over 1.3 million. At least one school in St. Paul, Minnesota, announced it would cancel classes Thursday because of a shooting threat. And roughly a dozen schools in the Pittsburgh area received threats this week, authorities said, with several placed on lockdowns as a result. The Macon County investigation remains ongoing. Anyone with information is encouraged to contact the Decatur Police Department. And the headline for this next story reads, "Firefighters investigate fire at Watterson Towers. Dateline Normal." Normal firefighters responded to Illinois State University's Watterson Towers on Wednesday afternoon for reports of a fire on the second floor. The fire occurred in a staff workroom located below the residential floors, and no students were injured or displaced, according to a news release from Normal Fire Department Inspector and Public Information Officer Matt Sweeney. Crews were called at 4:21 p.m. for an activated fire alarm on the south tower of the residential hall at 315 South Fell Avenue, Sweeney said. The Normal Fire Department also received numerous calls reporting smoke near the fitness center on the second floor. Upon arrival, firefighters found an activated sprinkler and a fire in a staff room connected to the fitness center, Sweeney said. They put out the fire and began checking for hot spots while other firefighters searched surrounding floors to make sure the fire had not spread. Finding no spread, crews began ventilating the building by using fans to blow smoke out through windows and doorways, Sweeney said. Sweeney described moderate fire and smoke damage to the workroom and some water damage throughout the second floor from the sprinkler system and fire hoses. He emphasized that the second floor mainly houses the fitness center and several offices, no residential space. The building has reopened to students and staff, Sweeney said, and the fire department cleared the scene at 6:36 p.m. He added the second floor will remain closed while ISU completes cleanup and restoration work. The cause of the fire remains under investigation, Sweeney said, and no damage estimate was available late Wednesday. And here are some news briefs. Starting at 7 a.m. Monday, the Constitution Trail will be closed on the north side of Rab Road between Linden Street and Normal Fire Station No. 3. The closure involves work to repair and resurface the asphalt surface. The project is anticipated to take 2 weeks to complete, weather permitting. Signs will be posted indicating closures. And Children's Discovery Museum to host Day of Play on September 21st. Presented by PNC Bank, the Day of Play will start at 10 a.m. and go until 3 at the Children's Discovery Museum and throughout Uptown Normal, providing all-day activities for children, their families, and caregivers. The day will feature STEM activities, mobile learning adventures, interactive learning activities, a touch a truck area, and an appearance by Cookie Monster from Sesame Street. The event is free and open to the public. Same day, reduced admission to the museum will be available for $5 through 5 p.m. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, September 13th, 2024. I look forward to reading part two with you next.